I'm Skynell Hughes, and on today's 360 View, we are going to question whether there's a link between the psychiatric drugs being prescribed to youths and the increase in mass shootings. Let's get started. The number of mass shootings in an academic setting is shocking when you compare the United States with the rest of the world. Now, most countries can count on their fingers how many incidents, while the United States over the last decade has amounted to hundreds. Those who commit these shootings often have a common characteristic of mental illness, psychological problems, family dysfunction, or a history of various forms of abuse. But while these issues are not new to society, the diagnosis of them are especially amongst the youth. Now, according to the latest data collected by the National Child Health Survey, all between 2003 and 2011, there was a 42% increase in the diagnosis of ADHD, all between the ages of 4 to 17 years. And with diagnosis comes treatment, and often it's in the pharmaceutical form. Therefore, you can see why there has been some speculation of a link between the increase in medication used to treat mental and psychological issues and mass shootings. But is that a fair connection? Joining me now is Chloe Carmichael. She's a clinical psychologist and author of the book, Nervous Energy, Harvest the Power of Your Anxiety. Welcome, Dr. Carmichael. Now, do you think parents and people in general are right all to be skeptical of pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and others, given the number of legal cases that have come down convicting these companies of fraud and other malfeasance?
Absolutely, Scotty. I think that it's almost a parent's duty to have at least a healthy level of skepticism, especially when we consider that the Journal of Molecular Psychiatry this past July came out with a groundbreaking analysis suggesting that SSRIs may not be as effective at all on depression as many of us have previously thought.
In your line of work, what role do SSRIs used for anxiety and depression and ADHD medicines like Ritalin and Adderall play?
Well, I mean, I think it really depends on the situation. Of course, many clients really respond to talk therapy. Studies in the past have often shown that a combination of SSRIs with talk therapy is actually the most helpful, but I think that Journal of Molecular Psychiatry article really has a lot of people wanting to look at some of that research again.
Do you ever find they have a positive impact on any of your patients?
Well, as a clinical psychologist, I don't prescribe medication. I do work in tandem with psychiatrists who do prescribe medication, and I oversee some of the treatment together. And I do think in some cases that they are certainly helpful. However, I think especially with children, it's really important that we look a little deeper and certainly not jump to medication at all as a substitute for talk therapy, because with young people these days, they're having less and less opportunities for meaningful interpersonal interactions, whether it's because of the rise of screen time or whether it's because mothers are working more and more and available less and less, as well as the fact that that screen time is becoming a lot more violent and a lot more attention sensitive, meaning every 10 seconds there's a new pop-up. So I just think it's really important that we don't look at medication and necessarily as a substitute for an interpersonal interaction.
Do you think these drugs impact the long-term health of patients and potentially damage their brain chemistry permanently?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, we do know, for example, with a lot of the ADHD medications, the kids have to go off of them in the summertime so that their physical growth can catch up, because for some reason, a lot of them seem to have negative impacts on the simple physical height of a child. As far as some of the other neurological impacts on the child, it's hard to know, but I would say, again, if you're using a drug to do something that you could potentially be training your mind to do instead, learning to control your attention and your focus with your mind, and you're turning too soon to a drug, you could be depriving yourself of the opportunity to learn those skills organically.
Do you think there is a push to get more and more children, especially young boys, on ADHD medicines? Are we clinicalizing normal adolescent boy behavior?
Absolutely. I think we used to treat it with discipline, and we used to treat it with get outside and run around the house 10 times and burn off that energy. I say this as a boy mom myself. I have a wonderful little boy who's full of energy, and they're absolutely different than boys and girls. And even making that simple assertion these days has become quite controversial. But yet, I think you're absolutely right that for many teachers, parents, whatever, it's just a lot easier to have a child that is not quite as energetic and talkative and who's just a lot easier to control and to quiet. And so sadly, I think we are pathologizing just good old-fashioned boy energy in some cases.
Do you see higher suicidal ideation in people who take ADHD medicines and SSRIs?
That's an interesting question. I'm not entirely sure of that research, but I would say that if you're using ADHD medication or SSRIs to treat something that actually really isn't going to be solved through that medication, then that can be very disheartening for a child who's taking medication and really not getting perhaps what they really truly need.
Do you think there's actual evidence of reason to study the link between violence, like for instance, mass shootings, and the use of these types of drugs?
Yes, I do, Scotty. In fact, I think it's really important to even think about some of the factors underlying why, as you said, we suddenly have these ADHD diagnoses skyrocketing, why we suddenly have so many children on medication. And to your earlier point, yes, there is a big pharma industry that profits with every single prescription that is written. And so if we have these young men who maybe are not getting enough quality time, perhaps with their parents, or they're in a school system that's overburdened, maybe somebody's throwing medication at them as a way to just settle them down. And then they're turning to these video games that often feature violence as a way to just cope or entertain themselves. And children with ADHD often do have a more difficult time making social relationships. And so all that time as well that they're spending in video games, they're less socially focused. Now, some people will say, well, they're making friends with online video game partners. But I think when you're partnering with an online friend over a violent video game, I'm not sure I would necessarily really look at that as a healthy form of friendship. And then moreover, when we think about we're in a culture that is normalizing abortion, as well as a decline in religiosity, which is what gives people a moral backstop and a sense of accountability in many cases, as well as abortion, of course, suggesting some, I would say, a casual attitude towards human life. I think that it is a legitimate question to look at these factors in tandem with the rise in mass shootings.
In your view, is there more positive or negative from these types of drugs?
You know, I would have to have, probably access to more data than I have to make a definitive statement about that. But I would definitely say it's important to look at medication as a last resort, generally speaking. We want to start with the least invasive treatment. So before I would look at medication, I would want to say, well, how much adult supervision is this child getting? Who is teaching this child how to control their mind, how to relate well with others, how to exercise self-discipline and get things done? If there's no adult constantly available for these young children, and we look at medication as a substitute for that, I think we're not only doing a disservice to our children, but we're actually also shortchanging ourselves, because these young children may not really grow to reach their full potential.
What alternatives are there? Are there strategies you and others employ that would work better than overprescribing such powerful drugs to vulnerable children?
Sure. Well, one of the first things that comes to mind is that there's also an epidemic of obesity, right? Which is often connected to a lack of physical activity. And so if a child has a restless energy, again, one of the remedies I might look at is saying, well, how much exercise is that child getting? When I look at alternatives, as you said, I mean, exercise not only, of course, burns off our excess energy, but it gives us an increase in dopamine and has a lot of other positive factors too, especially if you can get an exercise buddy or get involved in a sports team so that you're also having some positive social interaction. And social interaction has been shown to be a protective, resilient factor when trying to ward off mental illness or other negative stressors in life.
You know, as you look around the globe, doctor, I have to ask, do you see as many prescriptions in foreign countries like Europe, Asia, Africa? And why do you think traditional countries tend to not go down this route of using pharmaceuticals all to solve mental health problems?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. I would imagine it might have something to do, you know, with the FDA. For example, also in Europe, it's a lot harder to get genetically modified foods and things like that on the shelf. I think that some of those cultures have a little bit more of a careful attitude about what exactly is going in their bodies. And what exactly is their, you know, connection to nature? They also, you know, have shorter work weeks and value self-care and maternal leave and things like that a lot more in general. And I would certainly think that attitude would extend to potentially being too casual in just throwing medication at what could just be an energetic young man.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chloe Carmichael, author and clinical psychologist. So stay tuned when we come back. More prescription drugs and their possible connection to violent mass shootings right here on the 360 View.
Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. Wherever people long to be free, they will find a friend in the United States.
We came here peacefully. We are asking our minimum basic rights in this country as a human being.
Dentro la primavera araba e le varie rivolte nei vari paesi si sono inseriti i giochi delle grandi potenze, dei servizi segreti.
Color revolutions is one among several means to reach the goal of conquering foreign lands and bringing them under the helm of US Western economic interests.
Si può pensare ad un'architettura globale di democrazia.
Le rivoluzioni colorate sono un tassello del soft power americano.
The final goal of these theme revolutions is to ensure that there are no independent players in the world anymore.
Welcome back. We are talking about prescription drugs and mass shootings. Joining us now is criminologist Peter Squires. Peter, the Dunblane massacre took place at Dunblane Primary School near Stirling, Scotland, United Kingdom on the 13th of March, 1996, when Thomas Hamilton shot dead 16 pupils and one teacher, injuring 15 others before killing himself. It still remains the deadliest mass shooting in British history. Now, following the killings, public debate centered on gun control laws, including public petitions for a ban on private ownership of handguns and official inquiry, which produced the 1996 Cullen Report. What was the outcome of that inquiry and the report?
Right. Well, it was a huge debate. There was lots of pressure on either side. There was a very effective community campaign organized around the parents of the children killed, called the Snowdrop Campaign, and they lobbied hard for a ban on handguns. The Cullen report rather came down the middle. It sort of studied in detail the problem of gun violence and came up with a kind of compromise solution that guns for people to take part in sporting activities should be held in storage at secure armories, and then people could take them out to use them for their sport shooting activities. The gun lobby themselves considered this unworkable, and in the end, I think that the kind of compromise solution that Cullen was proposing, despite its sort of administrative and governmental support, was just blown away by, I suppose, public outrage. A number of Conservative MPs, it was a Conservative government at the time, broke ranks and voted to ban high caliber firearms. And then when the Labour government came, it was close to an election as well, which and it became an election issue. And in order to sort of steal the law and order issue from the Conservatives, Labour supported the idea of a complete ban, including 22 caliber pistols. And they passed a second piece of legislation that effectively banned all, bar a very few, handguns.
Now, the United Kingdom has had its share of terrorist attacks with the IRA and Al-Qaeda, but the British police force remain largely without guns. Why is that?
Wow, well, that's a big question. I mean, in a sense, that's partly why I'm involved. I do research on gun violence, but I also look at police armed response policy and practice, and I've researched and written about that. My feeling is that if only we can keep down the level of gun violence, the level of violence directed at the police, if that can be, a lid can be kept on that, then the pressure to permanently arm the police, routinely arm the police, will be kept under wraps to some extent. The police have been generally rolling out more and more tasers to frontline officers, and the taser is seen very much as a sort of intermediary weapon, less than lethal, and in a sense the whole debate goes back to a very British notion of policing by consent, minimum use of force, policing by consent. That's a debate, of course. There are some people who don't feel that the police are very consensual at all. And certainly the police forces we deployed around the world in India and Australia and South Africa weren't very much about policing by consent. They were garrison forces. The same happened in Ireland. But back at home in England and Wales, we were very much reserving the very best traditions of policing. And I think there's a certain amount of public support for that continuing. I don't think arming the police is especially popular, although the media only ever asked the question in the wake of a police killing. So they ask in the hot times. There's some pressure on the police from the police themselves, especially in the larger cities, London, Manchester, Liverpool, to extend arming. And we do have around 5% of police officers who are part of what are called armed response units, who are meant to be called if there's a suspicion that a suspect is armed. So routinely not armed, but armed availability is always there.
Okay, so then why is there a perception that there are little to no massacres in the UK and Europe? What difference in laws, practices, and traditions? Or is it really just the lack of media coverage?
I think that misperception is inaccurate. There have been five mass shootings in the UK, the most recent one, five people killed only last year. There have been numerous mass shootings in Europe, and a study recently appeared looking at mass shootings in Central and Eastern Europe, the former Soviet societies. And I think that study covers 70. So There have been a lot, and around the wider world, we've seen them in Australia, South Africa, Brazil, New Zealand. You know, this is not a purely American phenomenon. I'd say it's an overwhelmingly American phenomenon, but not a purely one. Something like 70% of the mass shootings worldwide occur in the USA.
In the US, when massacres are first reported, oftentimes there's this mention of mental illness of the perpetrator. But reporters seldom return to questions of mental illness until the trial is actually reported on. This is because under health laws, HIPAA, which protects sensitive patient health information from being disclosed without the patient's consent or knowledge. Do you think there's actually evidence or reasons to study the possible link between violence and mass shootings and the use of pharmaceuticals, drugs like SSRIs or ADHD medicine?
I think my short answer would be they're not clear. I think this is a very big issue. I think the studies generally have not been done in sufficient number to give definitive answers. On the broader question, yes, I do think there are links between mental health and violence, between early childhood trauma and violence. I've looked in the UK at gang-related violence and knife crime, and it's often the case that the people involved in it, this is the thing, as either perpetrators or victims, are troubled by their young lives. They have unresolved issues from their childhoods. They lived in very deprived environments. They were neglected or abused. And I think that that's a common factor in any studies of serious violence. Now, whether that's disproportionately so across the range of violence and in relation to mass shootings in particular, I don't think the evidence base is there yet. There has certainly, I agree with you, been a number of cases where mental health is brought up, but I think this is also part of a almost a kind of lay issue of understanding what mental health is, because anyone who does this, we tend to think they are not normal in some way, and we then point to psychological troubles, to stressors, to depression, to substance misuse, including prescription drugs. And all of that has to go into the mix. I don't think we can find, if you like, unfortunate phrase perhaps, the silver bullet that explains it all. I think it's a complete mess of factors that have cultural, social, psychological dimensions that need to be kind of put together in the mix to understand the problem. But, and this is the sort of $64,000 issue for me, I don't think we can rule out the prevalence of firearms and the easy access to them, and the way in which mass shooting has become a strange way by which certain people act out their trauma in the USA in particular.
Peter, do you have anything else you would like our audience to know?
Gradually, the evidence base is improving. But this thing, this whole issue, you know, anything around guns, you don't have to research guns very much to realize just how politically polarized it is and how powerful vested interests sit either side, and the evidence becomes very challenged and the debates are very partisan. But I think part of what I try to do and part of a number of colleagues try to do is to try and build that evidence base by which you can make some definitive conclusions. And there's a very good project that's been developed and written about recently called the Violence Project, which tries to look at the triggers, the inhibitors, the sort of alerts that are out there, and tries to address the kinds of triggering factors that send people off the rails and send them off the rails with a gun. That's the dangerous combination. These issues in themselves, I mean, we have it's right widely reported a knife crime epidemic. Now there's a limit to how many people you can kill with a knife, and in a sense that's fairly self-limiting, but a gun's a whole different ballgame. And I think the evidence base is emerging about the kinds of traumas, about the kinds of crises that people have, about the issues they have from their childhoods that trigger these kinds of problems, these massacres, these killings. And what we need to do is develop better intelligence about how to spot them in advance, how to intercept people who are going through those kinds of crises. And that's a public health issue. I know lots of people in the States don't like talking about gun violence as a public health issue, but it's people's health that's impacted in the end. And it's some very marginalized, isolated, troubled people ultimately that are causing these mass shootings. And I think we could do much better to intercept some of them.
Thank you. That was criminologist Peter Squires. You know, there are very few things in life which are more tragic than the loss of a child, especially if it could have been prevented. I don't find it wrong to question the link between pharmaceutical prescriptions and mass shootings, especially if it does help us prevent future incidents from happening. But you can't just put the blame on one item, because like with any other medication, it can be used for the good just as easily as it can be used for the bad. While some look at stricter gun control as the solution, it would be unfair to not only look at the outside factors, which society and pop culture have introduced. Social media, movies, video games, and other outlets, which not only promote violence, but also retaliation, should also hold some responsibility for the message they're continuously sending our youth. Sadly, there is no simple solution to ending mass shootings. However, while mental health has become a focus in this post-pandemic era, we should also make sure the easy and obvious solution for one does not make a world a more dangerous place for everyone else. I'm Skynell Hughes, and thank you for watching this edition of 360 View. Until next time.